Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad you're listening in. And if you have a question for Dr. Sandy as we move along today, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Sandy, welcome back. Nice to have you
with us. It is nice to be here.
And, you know, every time you're on, you pour, before you arrive, you pour through the literature and come up with something unusual or different.
Yeah. And, you know, I tell you, the first thing that came out of my mouth when I came in here and we sat down in front of the mic was this fact that there's a company in California that's come out with dog water. And this is not a new thing. I mean, there's been dog waters and cat waters available for some time, but these are unique in that they're flavored according to the dog's palate, and they have these tempting flavors: toilet water, puddle water, hose water, and gutter water. So if you're interested, then, you know, go to caninewatercompany.com and you can get those designer waters from California for your dog. And I wonder who's taste tested them. That's what I would like to know, you know?
Oh, man.
I know.
Safe for human consumption, you wonder?
I have no idea. But you know what? I don't care to be the one to try them, you know, because I'm not sure if I really like muddy water from puddles or toilet water. Yes.
I agree. Well, Dan and Mercer's been waiting a while already.
All right.
Let's go to Dan. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you to Dr. Sawchuk for your time. I've listened to you for years, even though I'm a first-time caller.
Well, I'm glad to have you. What can we do for you?
We have a 5-year-old spayed female black lab who weighs 72 pounds and is very, very active. 4 weeks ago, the day after cross-country skiing with her, as the trails up here we can take dogs on, which is great. These are wide, packed, and groomed trails. 4 weeks ago, the day after, she would not put all the weight on her right rear leg, only after getting up from naps. When she sat or was in the down position, that leg was not tucked tightly under her like her other rear leg, but was rather slightly splayed out. We rested her for 2 weeks. She never exhibited any problems walking or trotting on the plowed roads up here, yet we weren't comfortable with her situation. I took her to our vet, who moved her rear leg around and took x-rays. She suspected some soft tissue damages. There were no obvious problems on the films.
Okay.
She also stated that her hip conformation was excellent.
Good.
2 more weeks of rest after seeing our vet, we took her skiing just this last weekend as she was absolutely climbing the walls around.
Okay.
After skiing about 10K, she appeared fine until later that evening, and she hobbled pretty much on 3 legs that night, and now is back to being very shy about putting much weight when she first stands up. I can't notice any problems when we take her for a very short walk on the road so she can relieve herself.
Yeah.
But in the house, she stands with that rear leg slightly back and somewhat on her toes.
Yeah.
What do we got here, Sam?
Yeah, you know, and it sounds like your veterinarian was right on, you know, had good palpation of all the joints and taking x-rays. If they're not seeing any bony changes, and remember, it's sometimes really good, especially in these really muscular, active dogs, to do the orthopedic exam under sedation. That way you can, even though they're sedated, it relaxes the muscles a little bit, and you can get a better feel for, you know, differences between the joints, whether there's a, you know, slight swelling in a joint or something like that. You know, I'm uncertain what's going on, but it sure sounds like this would be something that your veterinarian may want to either send the x-rays that were taken in for second opinion, or have you visit with the veterinarian who is an orthopedic, you know, surgeon, or, you know, someone that deals with this kind of orthopedic stuff. Things that you may want to consider doing in the meantime would be, if you haven't already got her on an anti-inflammatory, you may want to consider doing that. There's several of them on the market for dogs. There's one called Rimadyl. There's another one called Etagesic. There's one that Marielle makes. I'm drawing a blank on the name, but there's whole bunches of them out there now that have, you know, they all can affect the GI tract of the dog, and so you want to give them with food. But for a few days, sometimes that just helps alleviate some of the discomfort. It may also be that you went back to full exercise, and running 10 kilometers for the first time after a period of rest, and if she's just been going out for brief walks, may have overdone it. Maybe just, a little bit faster paced walk, maybe a little bit longer walk on a leash, and then gradually work up to more exercise. So it's very possible that it's still whatever the soft tissue injury was, that you just went back a little bit faster. So I'd say, back to rest, anti-inflammatories, and consider getting a second opinion under sedation. So make sure she goes in without being fed breakfast.
All right. And thank you very much for calling. Good luck to you. Appreciate your call. An email from Mike from Westby. They have two kittens born September of 2008, about 5 months old. We're going to get the spayed and neutering done next week. We're struggling with whether to declaw or not. They will be indoors at least 95% of the time. I've read a lot about how inhumane it is to declaw cats. Is it really? Is laser declawing less painful and easier on them? And can they really be trained not to tear up our furniture?
Oh, these are all such good questions. And, it is such a controversial topic. And in some countries in the world, this is not even a topic because veterinarians can't do it unless there's a medical reason for it. And there's like a big push in California to try to get it outlawed there as well. So, it is one of those kind of controversial things that as veterinarians we do. Where I recommend it is, go ahead and get them spayed or neutered. But if you're in a situation where you already know that they're causing damage already, that you've done everything in your power to keep the nails trimmed, that you've introduced scratching posts, appropriate scratching posts. Remember, they need to be at least 3 or 4 feet tall, about 4 inches around, covered with the cat's preferred surface to scratch on, which is usually either upholstery or sisal carpet, something like that they can get a good dig in and shred. It needs to be placed in a spot that is socially significant. Most people hide the scratching post back by the litter box or someplace in a back room because they don't like the look of it. And where does the cat like to scratch? Usually right there in the front of the sofa where everybody can see as you walk in the house that you've got cats. That's where you need to put the scratching post. If they're already scratching on the furniture, you can cover it up with something to make the furniture less appealing. One of my favorite products is something called Sticky Paws. It's a double-sided type carpet tape that you can put on the furniture, and the cat doesn't like the feel of it because their hair sticks. But even just covering it up with foil or plastic wrap or bubble wrap, something like that, it may be effective as well. Doing all that, you can try soft paws, a little plastic rubbery nail caps that go on, but you still need to trim their claws to be able to do that. If you've tried that, then I think, a veterinarian usually is a little more comfortable about saying, let's remove the claws. If you remove the claws, your cat needs to stay in 100% of the time, not being allowed to go outside. And so this 5% of maybe being able to go out, unless you are out there supervising all activities, shouldn't be able to go out. Remember what declawing is. When we're taking claws off, it's not just removing the visible shell of the nail, but you need to remove the nail-producing tissue, which is attached down to the bone of that. So if you're looking, I'm looking at my hand right now. If everybody looks at their hand, it's where that, from the last joint of your finger down, that's what's being removed. Now, in cats, those are kept in a retracted state, so that's why we can do it. In humans, you'd be pretty, functionless if you lost the tips off of all your fingers. Same with dogs. Cats can be very functional with doing this. It is major surgery. You are amputating the distal digit, end of the digits off of all of the toes. When it comes to which way to do it, for young cats, I think it's kind of a flip of a coin which way you do. Standard declaw uses either like a guillotine type, like almost like a nail trimmer or a scalpel blade, and the leg has a tourniquet on it to stop the bleeding. They have to be on pain medication afterwards. Their feet are bandaged. There's a little more bleeding and so on with that as well. Laser declaw, less painful. They tend to recover faster postoperatively. But remember, lasers and the use of lasers does require somebody with some fairly good surgical skills. And for older cats, that would be the way to go because they don't need to have a tourniquet put on the leg. It stops the bleeding right away. So, yeah, I think I'm not going to say go for it or don't go for it, but I think you need to be, really honest with yourself as to whether you can keep your cats inside. Because if you can't, then those claws stay on, and any vet that takes them off, knowing that you're going to let your cat outside, should be, reprimanded. Yeah, I was going to say spanked, but no. Okay, yeah.
Reprimanded.
Reprimanded, yes.
Sue in Bailey's Harbor has a question for you. Hello, Sue.
Hi. Good to talk to you this morning.
Nice to talk to you, too.
I have a 10-month-old Bernese Mountain Dog named Blossom, and she is the most loving, wonderful dog we've ever had. She is definitely a mama's dog, but our adult son has just come to stay with us for a few days, and she's terrified of him. She doesn't know him. There's never been, you know, any problems with the two of them together, but the minute he walks in a room, she bolts out of the room or up the stairs, anywhere where she can hide.
Oh, poor baby.
And he's feeling terrible. He's nuts about her.
Yeah.
But she will not come near him.
Yeah.
Any suggestions?
Well, you know, so much of this is, I mean, individual dog variation, but it may also be, you know, just socialization that she got as a youngster to a wide variety of people. And it could be the way he walks, he talks, his tone of his voice. Who knows what's triggering this? But a few things that you could try. Number one, just for like natural calming, I'd put one of those dog appeasement pheromone collars on her called a DAP collar. Easy to use, relatively inexpensive, no side effects, and it has a natural calming effect. And it may, you know, again, is it going to make her totally like open to having people approach? No, but it's not going to hurt her. I would make sure that when he comes into the house, that you have her in a back room someplace, allow him to come in, have a seat in the living room, and have a, you know, a little baggie of her favorite treats, whatever that may be, whether it's chopped up pieces of chicken, freeze-dried liver, whatever it is, or maybe she's really into toys, so he's going to have a basket of tennis balls or something that she can play with. And he's not going to look at her, he's not going to reach for her, but you can just allow her to come into the room, and he's going to avoid eye contact. If he's going to use his voice at some point, he's going to talk in baby talk and kind of whispery, so it's not the deep voice. And then, you know, just have him, without using big hand motions, toss food in her direction. And maybe over time, if she realizes that he's not threatening, that he's going to give me wonderful treats, that he's not going to look at me, reach for me, tower over me, then maybe she'll be able to come a little bit closer and a little bit closer. And I would bet that if you continue to do that, that with time, she's going to turn around and say, wow, I really like having him around. And things are going to be better, and he may be able to be a little more normal around her. But just take your time.
Take your time. And thank you very much for calling, Sue. Appreciate your call. And Suzanne in Heartland, your turn now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a twofold question. I adopted a 5-year-old lab mix last May, and I've got him on a really good dog food, but occasionally when we're out for a walk, he decides he's going to eat another dog's poop.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm just wondering, when he does that, do I have to worry then about him getting worms, and why is he doing this?
He's doing it because he's a dog, and dogs eat droppings. And I can't tell you, I mean, my dogs think that when the snow melts, it's heaven in my backyard, because it's like all this rabbit droppings everywhere. And, you know, so eating other dogs' stool, it's not a function of your dog having any health problems, not being on a deficient diet. If your dog has normal hair coat, normal feces, normal weight, everything's fine, you're not having any GI distress, then you chalk it up as, you know, he's just being a dog. And it's the gross out factor. So what can you do with it? Number one, you know, keep him on a leash when you have him out. Preferably, if you have to have control of his head, with a head collar, either a gentle leader or a halter, so that he's not allowed to put his head down, because you've got control of his head. That way, when he sees stool, you can redirect him to have doing something else, such as, you know, let's go, you know, I'm going to throw a ball, or redirect you away from where the stool is, so you can get him away from it. And, you know, if he was eating his own, I'd say pick it up. But, you know, if you really want to be a nice neighbor, you could pick it up. Then it's not going to be sitting there. But that might be something, if you recognize that you've got a neighbor like I do that, you know, it tends to not pick up dog droppings, and they know who they are. I'm not sorry. I am the dog poop Nazi at my house, you know, and I want to make sure that that's, stools picked up, so we don't have problems like this, because not only is the stool in the environment a risk for your dog, yes, if he does eat it, if that dog has parasites like Giardia or whipworms or, you know, some of the other parasites that can be living in the stool in egg form, he can pick those up. And so you've got to be really, you know, careful if he's eating random fecal material. It's also a risk for humans. Contact with fecal material, even indirectly, walking over soil where that's been, especially in the case of hookworms in the summer, they can penetrate through our skin and cause some dermatologic issues. So lots of zoonotic diseases out there. So it comes down to whose problem is it? It's the dog's owner of the dog who's defecating out there. So, you know, try to catch them in the act if you can and let them know that it's bothering your dog and you.
And thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, and Jim in Milwaukee is online next, so let's go to Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hi, excellent show, and a real pleasure to be able to talk with you.
Thank you.
The question I have is, we had a male red Doberman for 11 years. We had to have him put down. Since then, we got a new female, a rambunctious 7-month-old.
Okay.
Towards the end of his life, he developed fatty tumors.
Mm-hmm.
My dad also has a male Doberman, and his has developed the tumors also.
Mm-hmm.
They recommend not to remove them because, you know, they're not painful or anything to the dog. Is there anything you can do to keep those from happening?
No. In fact, we see lots of humans that have this as a problem, mm-hmm. as well as dogs. They're very common. They're called lipomas, and they're a benign growth that can occur all over the dog's body, but usually over the chest wall and, you know, the sides of the dog and so on. Once in a while, we do need to remove them. To give you an example, I had a dog in the other day that's a service dog and wears a harness, and they developed a fairly good-sized lipoma right under his harness, so it was rubbing. And in that case, because it was a mechanical problem, we took it off. For the most part, if we're removing them, it's strictly for cosmetic reasons, and then you wonder, why are we doing this? And I can understand your concern about Dobermans with the short hair coat. I have a Doberman that comes into the clinic named Peter, and he has more lipomas than he does dog flesh. I mean, he is totally covered everywhere you look, and, you know, if he had a, you know, full hair coat like a sheepdog, you'd never know they were there, because they sure don't bother him. He moves normally. Everything's fine. So, you know, it comes down to genetics. And so kind of going back and looking at the family tree of, you know, what happened to, you know, the relatives of the dog that you've got, you may be able to predict whether it's going to happen or not. It is not a function of obesity. It's not a function of what you feed your dog. It's just purely what, you know, luck of the genes. So hopefully, you know, that your little girl that you have came from different stock and isn't going to have that as a problem.
Right. Thanks, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. Paul in Duluth, Minnesota. On to you now. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Larry, and hello, Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
I called you, I guess it was like about 3 months ago, about my 15-year-old chow mix who had developed incontinence.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had her to her doctor, and she is on Proen 25, and this is a real mouthful, diethylstilbestrol.
Yeah, DES, yep.
Uh-huh. DES?
Mm-hmm, that's okay, so.
Okay, it's like 98% effective.
Good,
so I'm happy with that, but she seems to be kind of spacey.
Huh.
And I'm wondering if that is kind of a side effect of the medication, because it's really hard to pin down, but, you know, I've had her for many, many years, so I notice even little changes in her behavior.
Yeah.
She's still eating the same amount of food, but she has, like, totally changed her eating schedule.
Okay.
In other words, I put out her... She gets kibble in the morning and some good quality canned food in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And what she'll do is she'll leave the canned food in the evening, and then in the morning she'll gobble down both the canned food and her dry food.
Yeah, a couple of things that it may be. The two drugs that you have her on, DES is an estrogen, and what we think is happening in many dogs as they get older is that their bladder sphincter, which has a lot of estrogen receptors on it, just becomes weaker and they become a little leakier. And you throw in the fact that she may be arthritic and not getting up and urinating as frequently, or has some underlying medical problem that could be making her produce more urine, that's just going to cause more problems for that weak bladder sphincter. So the estrogen is going to help with that. Side effects of that particular drug primarily are bone marrow suppression. And so whenever I have a dog on that, that's something that we monitor, their blood cell counts, to make sure that there isn't a problem. We're usually using it at very low doses. It's an extremely rare side effect, but it's just something that we pay attention to. The phenylpropanolamine, or PPA, or Proan, which is the brand name that you're using, is a drug that in the past was available over-the-counter for human use, and it was called Dexatrim. It was a diet aid for people. And when you read the box for humans, it said suppresses appetite, and as a side effect, you know, don't want to use it if you have a problem with urine retention. Well, for dogs, the number one effect that PPA has is that it tightens the bladder sphincter, and it doesn't have a lot of appetite suppressant effects. But that may be what's causing your dog's problem, is that if you're giving that particular drug at a time of the day, such as, you know, evening or in the morning, her appetite is just like, I don't feel like eating. So she may be experiencing some of the side effects from that particular drug. And you may want to be talking to your veterinarian about maybe playing with the estrogen dose rather than keeping her on that drug to see if she goes back into normal eating habits. The other problem with phenylpropanolamine, and this is why it got pulled off the market for human use, is it can cause hypertension or high blood pressure. And people that were taking it were usually not seeking medical attention and were taking this drug and then having strokes because they have their high blood pressure. And so it got pulled off the market for people. We don't see hypertension as commonly in dogs as we do in people, but it does happen, and it does happen when dogs get older. And so the fact that she's spacey may be that that particular drug is causing her to be a little hypertensive, and it's affecting her mentation. So when I have a senior citizen that I put on that drug, I make sure that I do pre-treatment blood pressure checks and then post-treatment blood pressure checks to make sure that we're not making things worse. So I hope that that's been done with your dog and you're not running into troubles. So could it be the medication? Yes. Could it be other things just like her age? We know that a good, 30 to, I can't remember what the number was. I just heard it, like 30 to 50%. It's phenomenal. Dogs that are like over 12 have cognitive decline. And she may have some senility going on too, which is just changing her sleep-wake habits and her eating habits. And she's just not quite all there. And that may be part of it. But I definitely check into these medication things because there could be reactions going on.
And good luck. Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate your call. Dick in Oak Creek will turn to you next. Hi, Dick.
I have a curiosity question about cats.
Okay.
We're on cats number 5 and 6 in almost 40 years, and we found that dark-colored cats like to lie in the sunshine where the light ones don't.
Huh.
We're kind of curious if you ever heard that, and if that's true, why do they do it?
Well, I have not heard that. And, you know, a couple things that come to mind, and I really don't think the cat's probably thinking of this, but, you know, light-colored cats, when they get a lot of sun exposure, we see a higher rate of skin cancer in cats. They will get squamous cell carcinomas of their ear tips and nose and so on. So, you know, I don't think cats are, you know, stopping and thinking, oh, you know, I don't have a lot of pigment, I'm going to burn easily. But, you know, it may be that their skin gets a little uncomfortable when they're laying in the sun just because they don't have the pigmentation to allow them to be able to get as much sun exposure. So I don't know. I have no idea. We can't ask them, you know, are your ears getting a little tingly, you know, but it's probably good that they don't lay in the sun as much. So, but I'll have to, like, you know, start taking a poll of my clients and see if that's truly, you know, a common, you know, thing that dark cats, because I know my dark cat loves, I mean, he's like a little solar collector. He just lays there and stretches out in the sunbeam. And remember, the UVB light that the sun is producing, and, you know, in some of the other UV, I don't know, all the different burning rays, is that the A rays? I don't know. But anyways, I know that when you have animals that actually need UVB light, like tortoises and things, you can't get it through glass because that will block it. So, you know, some of the useful vitamin converting rays for lights is not going to go through the glass. So I really don't think a white cat's going to burn that's totally indoors. It's usually when they're outside in sun exposure.
Well, Tiger, our cat, likes to get up on the fireplace mantle and then behind the television set.
Nice and warm. There
we
go.
Nice and warm. Mm-hmm. We have a question from Bobby in Stoughton regarding their six-month-old female golden retriever. I have had differing opinions regarding spaying, she says. She's had vaginitis, and I have been told that if we spay her before her first heat, she'll have a better chance of having multiple bouts of vaginitis over her lifetime. The other opinion is if we spay before her first heat, her chance of mammary tumors later in life will be decreased.
Oh.
What's your opinion? Spay before or after the first heat?
The pros and cons. Okay. So almost all female dogs, puppies, will end up with a little bit of puppy vaginitis. But my guess and what I'm seeing more of in labs and golden retrievers is an anatomical variant that we call, I mean, the typical term is called a redundant epivulvar fold. Some people will call it a recessed vulva. It's where the vulva is kind of buried in a little donut of skin, mm-hmm. and so they get more skin irritation, urine scalding, and thus secondary vaginal irritation. There is nothing in the literature to prove one way or the other as to whether having a heat cycle is going to make that vulva conformation better or not. But I let people know that it might be something you'd want to consider. Letting them have a heat cycle may enlarge the vulva, have it kind of pop out of that donut of skin, and maybe help prevent some of the issues that are associated with that. But I also let people know that, you can't let these dogs get overweight, and to be prepared that they may need to have, for lack of a better way of calling it, a butt tuck. It's kind of like a reverse facelift. You have to take a moon-shaped piece of skin out over the rear end and kind of pull everything up so that the vulva has a little bit more normal conformation, isn't buried. So I don't know if that's what your dog is dealing with, but that's probably why you're hearing those things about maybe letting her have a heat cycle. And you're right. The more heat cycles a dog has, the greater the risk of developing breast cancer. In fact, dogs spayed after two, the damage is pretty well already done. The repeated hormonal stimulation of the breast tissue can result in them developing, having a much higher incidence of breast cancer as they get older. Dogs that are spayed prior to having a heat cycle, you virtually eliminate the chance of them developing breast cancer. So it's kind of a, take your chances. And can I tell you, if it was my dog, I wouldn't purchase a dog with that vulva conformation. I mean, because it's just nothing but a pain. But if I had one, I'd let her have a heat cycle.
All right.
So I think there it's worth it. Yeah.
Carl and Racine, on to you now. Hi, Carl.
Hi there. This is a question for Dr. Sandy. You had mentioned about fecal matter from family pets, whatever, in anywhere, but I'm thinking about in my yard.
Mm-hmm.
My grandkids like to play back there, and as this winter progressed, of course, you don't get all of these things up, and I just was lucky enough to clean it. But I'm wondering, is there something that can be used to treat the lawn to kill those parasites? Because they like to do the slip and slide during the summer and all that stuff,
Well, these are good questions, and the number one thing that you want to do is make sure that your dog is free of intestinal parasites, and the best way to do that is to keep them on a monthly internal parasite control drug, sometimes known as heartworm prevention, because they have therapy in there for getting roundworms and hookworms, which are going to be the two big zoonotic parasites that dogs are going to be transmitting. So your question is there anything you can do? Well, number one, make sure that you're having your dog checked once or twice a year, at least once a year, having a routine stool sample check to make sure your dog is negative for any parasites. If your dog is positive for hookworms, this is the time of the year to get them treated because they are going to die off with freezing weather. We see a much heavier problem with this in the southern states because they just don't get the freeze-off that we have here, and so that's why it's a more prevalent parasite down in that area. But if I diagnose a dog with hookworms in the summer that's been defecating in the yard and it's rained and you haven't been really consistent about picking up stool, I tell them avoid all skin contact in that area until everything's frozen again. And so, that again, it's just, normal public health type stuff. Roundworms, on the other hand, are very resistant, and your grandkids aren't going to run into trouble with those with contact, but more with soil ingestion. So if they get dirt on them and they don't wash their hands and they eat their food, they can be picking up those parasite eggs if your dog happens to be shedding those as well. Those can survive like forever in the environment. And what has been written up as a way of dealing with a contaminated yard, I'm not kidding. This is what's in the press and what they tell you to do. Public health says to do: pave it.
Oh.
You can burn it. Okay. Burn all vegetation so that you heat the topsoil level up. Rototill the top 6 inches over repeatedly so that it dries. That's why 15% of soil samples kind of randomly selected around the United States are positive for roundworm eggs. It's just that's how prevalent it is. And that's why it's up to us as veterinarians and you as a pet owner to make sure that you are keeping your dog preferably on year-round internal parasite control.
All right. There you have it. Thank you very much, Carl, for your call. And let's get Dave and Grand Chute on board here. Dave, hello to you.
Hi, good morning. We have a schnauzer who's almost 12 years old, and he's been diagnosed with lymphoma. And we just started him on prednisone. I'm kind of wondering what we're looking forward to. I've heard about the urination, but...
Yeah. Unfortunately, lymphoma or lymphosarcoma is a cancer of the lymph nodes, as you've found out, and when, you know, we have options for treatment, chemotherapy is definitely the way to go if you're going to be wanting to give your dog the greatest chance of having a longer life. Prednisone, when we use it, will fairly quickly shrink the lymph node size, and I call it a prednisone honeymoon. It's going to give you a few weeks of enjoying your pet while they're comfortable, but the cancer is going to come back with a vengeance. And once you start a dog on prednisone, it pretty well makes the cancer resistant to chemotherapy. So I really sit down and have a heart-to-heart with the owners. And if they say, you know, we're thinking about chemo, then I won't dispense prednisone.
We ruled out chemo. We talked to the vet. He wouldn't even do it to his dog again.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I work with a very busy oncology department, and what I see is dogs that can live for months to years happily. And the levels of drugs that are used are not at the same dose and so on that we use in people, and pets tolerate it well. I'm just going to read a little quote here. Fewer than one-third of veterinary patients have unpleasant side effects from chemotherapy. It is something that it can occur, but they can be managed. And so it's not a given that your dog's going to run into troubles. But what you can expect is about 6 to 8 weeks. And so I'm going to say, I hope your dog makes it through spring. Enjoy every day you have with your dog, because you really only have a matter of a few weeks left.
Yeah. I've done some reading online too, but other side effects while he's on the prednisone besides the, I understand, urination a lot.
Yeah. They are going to urinate more and drink more water. And don't water starve him, because he needs to have the water while he's on this drug.
Sure.
Their appetite may improve. And if he's been sick before, now we're going to see him, you know, probably eating a little bit better now that he's, on prednisone and his lymph nodes are shrinking. But it will, in a normal dog, sometimes they become ravenous. And so you may see them defecating more and trying to steal food. Those are going to be the big things that you may see. He's not going to be on it long enough to see some of the more chronic side effects such as hair loss, decreased muscle mass, pot-bellied appearance, and so on, which can happen with long-term steroid use. 6 to 8 weeks, it's a wonderful honeymoon for your dog. And again, the side effects of him drinking more are minimal, considering the fact that you're going to have some good quality time with him. And I'm very sorry that your dog has cancer. Yeah.
If I could ask one quickie about the chemo again, does that, which the statistics you gave, is that regardless of age? I mean, he's almost 12, like I said.
Remember, age isn't a disease. And if his other body organs and everything were fine, we'll see, older pets, and cancer does occur in older pets. I mean, we don't see it happening as frequently in younger pets. What we know is that, once pets start getting older, that about 50% of dogs and about 35% of cats will develop a tumor at some time in their life. So it's very, it's a way most of our pets are going to end up dying of cancer at some point in their life. And you know, I see a lot of Schnauzers living a happy life out to 15, 16 years of age.
Yeah.
So, you know, would you have been able to give your dog by using chemotherapy a few more months or years? And when you look at it as percentages, you know, if someone said to you, you know, here's some chemo, we may be able to give you five more years of life, and we, you know, same thing for your dog, but you put it in dog terms, you know, maybe another year of life. That's big. That's a lot of dog life there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you much.
You're welcome. Enjoy your time.
Thank you, Dave, for calling. Appreciate your call as well. And yeah, sometimes we have some sad.
It is, and it's tough decisions because, especially like in the economy, this type of thing, chemotherapy and radiation therapy is not inexpensive. So, you know, and this is where, you know, really considering if you get a new dog, get health insurance. I mean, I just used it on my dog. She had dentistry and oral mass done and paid for, you know, 2/3 of the procedure. So, you know, if a vet needs health insurance for her pet, then I think the average person does too. Yeah.
We have an email from Claire, who shares her home in Eureka, California, with four cats, all domestic short hairs, all adults, all rescues. I recently bought a Furminator and am impressed with the amount of fur coming off the cats. But I'm wondering, is it safe to remove all that undercoat? Don't cats need that coat for warmth? I'm concerned that I may be doing more harm than good by stripping them of all that loose hair.
Yeah, you can overdo it. And in fact, I have done that using a Furminator with my own pets. So, you know, it comes down to, you know, if there's, you know, there's shedding, but if you are, you know, finding that the hair is getting a little thinner or whatever where you're doing it, obviously you're doing too much. But it is one of the better grooming tools that I've seen there, especially for short-haired pets. It seems to work really, really well at getting some of that undercoat out. So, you know, just don't overdo it. But you know, it may help keep your house a little bit cleaner by having it, you know, all trapped at one time.
Yep. Brad in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Brad.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for calling.
I just had a quick question. I have an 11-year-old chocolate lab, 95 pounds. And the only reason why I mention his age and his weight, he has an allergy, and he itches quite a bit. It wasn't as bad when he was younger. I kind of kept an eye on it, and I do, you know, tiny bits of oil here and there, and it helped him through his allergy seasons. Now, as he's getting older, it seems to be progressing, and I'm more worried, I guess, about his skin and his bones. Because he's so big, he spends a lot of time with his back end suspended by one leg, and he's itching constantly.
Oh, poor guy.
Right. Again, yeah. You know, and I want him to be comfortable as his age goes on here, and I watch him, and, you know, he gets it. It feels so good. He's licking and licking when he's doing it.
Oh, boy. But, you know, this is not a quick question, and so I'm just going to give you a little heads up on this. Number one, when you've got a dog with allergies, they will get worse with time, okay? So it's very common to start mild, and every season they continue to get a little bit worse.
Okay.
And we get allergies. We get hay fever. Dogs get allergies, they itch. And my guess is that your dog probably has some underlying secondary infections on top of this. So if you have not taken him into your veterinarian to have some cytology done of the ear goo and the toe jam and, you know, everything else that where he may have some changes, get that done. Because
we had taken him in a while back, and what they noticed on his hair follicles that, you know, how a chocolate is, you know, the straight chocolate, but on the tips of some of them, he had a blonde on it, and they're checking for a fungus, and that came back as negative.
Okay, good, good.
And they were wondering if that might have had something to do with it, and they said I trained labs for hunt tests.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And I'd never heard of that, and I was like, wow, okay. So they said that wasn't an issue. And we had him on a medication for a while, and they said if it dies down, we're going to pull him off because they were worried about intestinal issues or anything like that with, you know, with unneeded medication.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, when it comes to medicating, it kind of depends on the severity of the allergies. For some dogs, some oral antihistamines, a topical steroid spray here and there can keep them under control, treating the secondary infections. For other dogs, we're looking at jumping to other systemic drugs such as cyclosporine. There's a drug called Atopica that we use. For a big dog like that, it's going to be pretty pricey, but very effective at controlling the itching with, you know, you have to talk to your veterinarian about the pros and cons of the side effects. There's another line of drugs that I like that's by a company called Sovigal, and they have one that's called Duxo Calm. Talk to your veterinarian about that. It's a shampoo, a spray, you know, and so on that really helps change the skin barrier for dogs that have allergies, and that may be another thing to consider too. Again, a little pricey, but definitely worth it. And then, you know, at this point, maybe it's kind of late in his life, but allergy testing and getting him on desensitization shots. But I think at this point, I'd rather at 11 years of age, since it can take a couple of years to actually start kicking in, I'd probably avoid going through that route and instead, you know, be looking at what can we use either systemically or topically to make him comfortable.
Thanks, Brad. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Larry Mueller here. If you want to join in with a question, give us a call at 800-642-1234. And Dr. Sandy, let's go to Don in Eau Claire next. Don, hello to you.
Yes, hello to both you, Larry and Dr. Sandy.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I've got a wonderful little Shih Tzu Bichon mix. She's 6 years old. Of course, she was spayed early in life. But she was diagnosed with IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, after she was scoped and biopsied. And it showed up early in life, about 6 months of age, with vomiting and diarrhea. And so she was placed on prednisone, and she's been on prednisone all this time. Basically, it's 5 milligrams every other day when things are going good, but up to one tablet every 12 hours when we have a flare-up. In addition to that, she has chronic diarrhea, and her diet is very controlled by the veterinarian. But she was born without a tail and short front legs, so she's a little abnormal in her structure. But the IBD has been a very difficult thing to live with. She's suffered a lot with this. She weighs about 23 pounds. She's gained weight because of the prednisone use.
Yeah.
And I'm quite concerned about the prednisone and its long-term use, even though it is only 5 milligrams tablet.
But that's still a big dose for a little dog, and using it chronically like that. There's some other things that you may want to talk to your veterinarian about trying. I don't know what you're doing. You said you've got your dog on a controlled diet. Do you know? Can you tell me what diet your dog's on?
It's a dry food through the vet. I don't recall the exact name of it.
Yeah,
she does have other drugs that she's on as well. She does take cimetidine for acid reflux, and she takes. When she has vomiting, she gets the metoclopramide syrup. But that's very rare. But the diarrhea is a big thing. And she gets metronidazole liquid for that.
Okay.
And that does work. But she suffers, like I say, with the intestinal GI upset. And diarrhea.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, I'm concerned about the long-term use of the prednisone any dose. And also, is there anything else that can be tried? Acidophilus or something like that,
You know, good questions. Number one, I would make sure that you have her on. Usually, when we've got dogs with IBD, the typical diet that we will put them on is one called ZD, or it's a hydrolyzed protein diet that Hills makes, and have them on that and only that, because a lot of dogs with IBD, it's a food hypersensitivity, and this way they'll get all their nutrition, but their body doesn't know where the protein's coming from, so that it helps alleviate some of the allergic problems. So check and see if that's what your dog's actually eating.
Hydrolyzed
protein. It's just called ZD, okay?
ZD by Hills.
Hills, yeah. Okay. Other things that I'd be looking into is, if you have not had your dog looked at for, had a GI blood work done, there's a gastrointestinal lab down at Texas A&M University, and typically with dogs and cats with chronic IBD, we will be running periodically a cobalamin folate levels. Many dogs that have either bacterial overgrowth or problems with inflammatory changes in their gut will be cobalamin deficient and need to have that given to them, and the way we give it is we teach owners it has to be given by injection. It doesn't work being given orally. And so we have many dogs and cats with IBD that need to be on cobalamin supplementation, and we just teach owners how to give the injections, and they live with that, and they do quite well with it. So if you haven't had that tested, that needs to be done. Other drugs that we would use, there's an intestinal antibiotic that can sometimes take down some of the inflammatory change. It's called Thailand powder, and again, some dogs do well with that. And there's another instead of using prednisone, there's another steroid that has fewer side effects called budesonide. And we will switch many pets instead of being on prednisone over to that as a form of steroid as well. There's also, if we've got a lot of colon inflammation with inflammatory colitis, there's a drug that's like a it's a sulfa type drug that can help alleviate some of the inflammatory changes in the gut. It's kind of got like an aspirin type component in it. And this would be something to talk to your veterinarian about with pros and cons of using that. But just using prednisone as the only drug, and then other drugs to kind of put the fire out, which, you know, antiemetics and things like that, that just sounds like, you know, there's some other things that could be done. And, mm-hmm. This would be a case where if your vet's kind of like, I don't know what else I can do, talking to a specialist. And within the state, there are many internists all over the place in the Milwaukee area, Waukesha, here in Madison.
Eau Claire area?
Eau Claire area. Let me see. Well, I think
that's
you're pretty
from
close
Eau Claire.
To. Yeah, probably. That's probably closest to go to University of Minnesota's vet school. So not mm-hmm. to send you out of state, but yeah. That would probably be the closest place to go for you. And even having just the records and things sent to see if they can come up with different answers for you.
And good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Good luck to you, Don. Appreciate your call. Eric emailed us and wonders, should I be worried about the peanut butter that my dog doesn't always get out of the Kong? Could he get sick if I don't clean out the Kong fully after each time I fill it with peanut butter?
Oh, well, you know, with that information that just came out, in fact, I'm sitting here with an email that I got from the Center for Disease Control on information for veterinarians regarding pets and the peanut butter and peanut product recall because of salmonella. You know, and that would be something to be concerned about if you're using, and I'd recommend going either to the CDC site or the AVMA website will also have lists of recalled products and things like that. So making sure that you're not feeding anything like that. Yeah, that is something to be concerned about. And I think we as pet owners, we don't wash our pets' dishes out often enough. And, leaving things in there to, become rancid could cause some health issues for your dog. And I like to put Kongs in the dishwasher. I think getting a bottle brush and cleaning it out after your dog has had it. And so you may have to have more than one if you've got one that's, going into the dishwasher mm-hmm. and getting cleaned. But, use a bottle brush, get in there, scrub all that stuff out, because the way Kongs are made, most dog tongues can't get all the way to the end. They'll keep trying, and that's the joy of it, but you will have to help your dog by keeping that area clean.
And Lori has a 2.5-year-old Maltese, has been fighting the battle of dark tear stains under his eyes. I've tried various products on the market without success. What causes those stains, and is there anything we can do to prevent the condition?
Well, those are good questions, too. With having two English bulldogs with face folds and kind of bulgy eyes, I periodically will have trouble with that as well. My guess is that your dog probably has hair rubbing on the surface of the eye, a little excessive tearing. Remember, the tears that dogs produce can have a chemical in it called porphyrin. And the porphyrins that are in the tears, which are a natural ingredient, it's also in saliva, which is why you'll see pets that some pets will have actually that brown or dark discoloration around their mouth or on their feet, kind of a rusty brown to black discoloration if they're chronic lickers. That porphyrin, when it reacts to light, will turn that rusty brown to black color. So number one thing is keep the hair out of your dog's eyes. Keep the face trimmed short if you can. It may not look quite like your typical Maltese, but it's going to make your dog feel more comfortable. And just physically cleaning the tears on a daily basis with, a little compress or something like that may help as well. One of the products that I've used that I've had some success with, which I thought worked, better than some of the other over-the-counter products,
sure.
And again, it's over-the-counter, is one that I actually bought at a cat show, but you can order it online. It's called Eye, as in eyeball, Eye Envy. And it's a two-part product, a powder and a liquid, and it seemed to work quite well. So, check out their website, and, maybe that might be something you'd want to try. But there's several other products, and they're mainly just kind of bleaching agents. You have to be careful around using it around the eyes, but, keep that hair out of the eye, and that'll help prevent some of the excessive tearing.
All right, on to Bruce in Denmark. Bruce, hello to you.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Two quick lab questions. We have a wonderful 4-month-old male lab, and we are going to get him neutered. The question is when. The vet says 6 months. I've had dog trainers tell me, no, wait a while until they can fully, more fully physically develop, and then The senior member of the firm is our 10-year-old lab, and I've heard rumors that Rimadyl and labs can sometimes have some adverse effects.
Well,
and thank
yeah.
you very much.
All right.
Yeah,
thanks for calling.
Two good questions. When it comes to neutering male dogs, there isn't anything really cast in stone as to when would be the ideal time. Letting him go through puberty and develop a little bit may change his physical appearance. He's going to have more secondary male sex characteristics, such as the broader chest, kind of a little more muscling and so on. Neutering them pre-puberty, they tend to be just, you know, maybe a little bit narrower chest, a little bit more gangly. But, you know, is it going to be affecting his quality of life? No. Is it going to affect his appearance? Maybe just a little bit. So that would be something to consider. The big problems with waiting until, you know, he's gone through puberty is, one, unwanted puppies, because he may want to go wandering and looking for love. He may develop some unwanted male behavior problems, such as humping, leg lifting. I mean, dogs will do that, too, even if they're neutered, fighting with other boy dogs. So there may be some behavior issues that could raise their ugly head and become a problem and may not go away as successfully as neutering them as a youngster. So you really do have to weigh out the pros and cons of both those things. If he's a pet dog, and then I'd say, neuter him young, get it done, and not have to worry about some of the male behavior problems that we run into. Your question regarding Rimadyl, every drug, all the anti-inflammatories that are on the market, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, can have problems. And I think labs got a little overrepresented, primarily because we see a lot of arthritis and problems because we see a lot of overweight labs, and they are one of the top breeds in the country. And as a result, we see more of them with arthritis as they get older. And so we were using a lot of Rimadyl in those dogs. Rimadyl, as a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, can cause some liver problems and GI problems, which is why when I'm using it in dogs, I always make sure that, especially if for long-term use, that I do a pre-treatment liver panel to make sure that the liver is working fine, and kidneys, because we sometimes forget about that, but kidney disease can get worse. So anyways, get that lab work done, and hopefully your dog will be fine.
And thanks for calling Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. And lots of callers. Let's go to Dean in Vulcan, Michigan next here. Dean, hello. Thank you for calling. Dean, are you there?
Yep.
Let's see. Do we lose Dean, or is there something that I'm doing wrong? I don't think so.
Well,
let's try Pam. Pam, are you there? Hello.
Yes, I am.
All right.
Thanks for taking my call.
And what's on your mind?
Okay, I have, he'll be 10 years old, a blue tick coonhound. He's not really an outside dog. He owns the couch.
Okay.
Okay. He does get a lot of exercise. We do let him in a large pen to run. But I'll say for the last maybe 4 or 5 years, he has developed this odor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's atrocious.
Okay.
His ears, when I clean his ears because he's got the long ears, and I get this constant black gook coming out of his ears.
Yep.
And I use the EpiOptic, and I've used that. We've even had ear drops for him. We've had antibiotics for him. He's even been on a steroid for it.
Yep.
He also has to have the anus gland popped or cleansed every couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a benign large tumor on his shoulder, and we just cannot figure out where this odor is coming from.
Well, you're hitting a lot of the top spots, but a couple of things to be thinking about. As dogs get older, their skin chemistry will change a little bit, and they sometimes develop a greasier hair coat. And a lot of hounds, I used to have Basset hounds, and I can understand the odor issue because they did have a very houndy type odor. best thing you can do is be bathing your dog frequently and washing the bedding at least once a week. Blankets, anything that they're laying on needs to be washed, or you'll end up getting that kind of like dirty, you know, bedding smell that, and that's just going to keep adding to it. So the top things to be looking for, number one is dental disease. Flip that lip and look all the way back at those molars. A 10-year-old dog, if you've not had your dog in for dentistry, this is dental health month. So, you know, get those your dog's teeth taken care of, because that is a prime source of odor, especially if they're licking themselves or anything like that. They're depositing that infected saliva.
He licks his paws all the time.
Yeah. The other thing to do is, you know, be looking elsewhere on his body for signs of infection. And the fact that he's licking his paws and he's got this black debris in his ear that's pretty stinky, and my guess is it probably smells like a dirty tennis shoe, if I can describe it. He probably has a total body yeast infection. And we'll see this in dogs with allergies. And when I get a dog in that's doing a lot of foot licking and ears like, you know, that you're describing, I'll actually take some of the material from the ear, look at it under the microscope, and confirm that there's yeast there. I'll also look for yeast in other spots of the body. It's normal to see low levels of yeast in the ear, but if there's lots of it there, or we find yeast in other places, like in the lip folds or between the toes, and sometimes it's a little trickier getting samples from there, but you can. It's easy, and you can do little impression smears, use a little spatula and collect the material. Then we're looking at, he needs to be treated for his whole body for a yeast infection. And the typical drug we use is one that's called ketoconazole, and we use it for about a month. And then, you know, considering using antifungal shampoos as well. And the one that I typically use is one that's called Ketochlor. That's just one brand. There's a number of them out there as well. The anal gland issues, again, that's something that periodically you'll get a little bit of, you know, discharge coming out. That's a very metallic, foul smell. It's not going to be constant. And so, you know, having those looked into definitely is going to alleviate one of the sources of body odor. But I would bet that he's got a yeast infection in his ears, on his feet, maybe his face folds, and that he may have some dental disease that's adding to it. So time to go back to the veterinarian and get those things looked into.
And thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it. We got an email from someone. Okay. I'm not sure who. We're about to inherit an 8-week-old Chihuahua that our daughter got last weekend, thinking it would be a great companion for her 8-month-old puppy. Unfortunately, the puppy cries so loud at night and won't keep quiet down that she's afraid she will be evicted from her apartment. When we get this puppy, what can we do to calm her at night? We have a house, so no worry about neighbors, but hate to see the puppy so unhappy.
And them unhappy, not getting any sleep at night. So a couple things that they can try. There's been a lot of research that's come out of Europe regarding using, and I've mentioned it already earlier in the show, a product called Dog Appeasement Pheromone, or DAP. And it comes in collar form, an atomizer that you plug in. Very effective for the social adjustment of a puppy leaving its home and going into a new environment. What Dog Appeasement Pheromone is bitch nipple pheromone. It's the pheromone that's produced by mother dogs around their nipples so that when puppies are nursing, they go into this calm, relaxed state. And it still, even though it's in a synthetic form, that's been found to be fairly effective. And that is one use that I really think is a totally appropriate use, is to use that. I'd make sure that the crate is actually put in a place where you can hear the dog, such as in your bedroom, because, you know, some puppies just need to know that someone's around. You know, I don't want the dog sleeping with you, but I think having the crate in a nearby area so that if they do wake up and they have to go to the bathroom, you can get them outside so they can go and then come right back in again. So, you know, those are a couple of things to consider trying. But remember the little saying, a tired dog is a well-behaved dog. Yeah. And even an 8-week-old puppy can still be played with at night and, you know, taken for little walks outside. You got to watch with the cold weather, though, with a little Chihuahua. But, you know, lots of exercise before they go to bed is going to help with getting them to be a little bit sleepier as well.
Mary from Madison says, you mentioned having pet insurance for your dogs. What type of insurance do you recommend?
Well, there's many companies out there, and I recommend that people start, you know, looking into, you know, what the different benefits are from different companies. My, I use one called VPI Insurance, Veterinary Pet Insurance, is what I have for my pets. It's one of the older ones that have been around. Nestle Purina has just come out with pet insurance as well, and that would be another one to be looking into. That you have to make sure that they're able to sell insurance and be able use it in your state. And so they'll often ask which state do you live in and whether you can actually get it or not. So there's several companies out there, and you know they all have slightly different programs, and I think it's up to you as a consumer to figure out which one's going to work best for you. For my dogs, because I'm able to do all the preventive care and so on, I don't care about that. I'm not a surgeon, and I need to be able to have somebody that my dog needed to have some oral surgery done that was able to do it for me. And of course, I pay just what anybody else in the state sure. does. That's the rules at the vet school. So, you know, I walked out of there with a bill that was very reasonable for the amount of work that was done. And but it's still, you know, $700 check for dental stuff was, you know, like, ooh, that's kind of been a dent in the budget. And it helps. I mean, I ended up getting over $400 back as part of my payment. So, you know, they usually don't cover 100% of everything, but many of the programs cover about 80% of your costs.
All right. On to Lisa in Cottage Grove. Lisa, hello to you.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a yellow lab who has chronic ear infections, and I know most of the time it is yeast, but it's just constant. And she hates when I have to clean her ears out. It's just such a huge battle because she's like 95 pounds, and there is nobody to help me with this.
Yeah, poor baby. It probably hurts. Yeah.
Yeah, and it does get pretty red and irritated in there. I sort of am at my wit's end. Struggling with this. I don't know what to do now.
Yeah, the most common reason why dogs have chronic recurrent ear infections is usually because they have underlying allergies. And sometimes we have to take the approach of, yes, ears are the thing that you're seeing, but we need to treat the whole body. And so, you know, talking to your veterinarian about what can we do either through diet, you know, adding in essential fatty acids, you know, antihistamines, treating systemically for yeast infections too, rather than just topically. If her ears are that painful, sometimes we have to go with oral medications, pills that she swallows to be able to treat the ear infection.
Well, we've done that. We've done the whole gamut.
Yeah. And then the other thing too is that, you know, sometimes when we treat the ears, we can't even as a veterinarian get down in there with our otoscopes and have a good look to see just how bad things are. But the statistics are that about a third of dogs with chronic recurrent ear infections have ruptured eardrums and have middle ear infections as well. And so you may want to look into having her ears evaluated while she's under anesthesia and even be thinking about, you know, maybe a referral to a dermatologist that has a video otoscope, something that they can get in there, a little smaller device and actually look in and see what's going on in there. And sometimes we even resort to doing CT scans of the skull to be able to see, do we have bone involvement or other things that could be causing this infection to keep coming back and cause her so much discomfort and pain. So, you know, even though it's just ears, this can turn into what I like to call the ear extravaganza. So, you know, going down the allergy route, going down the do we have deeper infection, you know, in structures that we can't see, and sometimes visits with specialists as well.
All right.
Her vet had said something about surgery.
Yeah. And sometimes when we have really severe chronic changes in the ear, you get so much scar tissue production that the ear canal itself shrinks down so that you don't get good air circulation. And when that happens, then guaranteed you're going to have infections over and over and over again because you've got all these nooks and crannies that we can't treat effectively. And there's so much scar tissue that even treating orally with medications and putting it into her bloodstream still can't even penetrate to get there. And so there are dogs where we have to actually remove the diseased ear canal. And it's called a TICA or a total ear canal ablation. That is definitely end of the road. We have nothing else that we can do and throw at your dog. I probably see the surgery done more often in Cocker Spaniels than I do in Labrador Retrievers. But again, I wouldn't jump to that, but that might be something that has to be done down the road.
All right.
Are they deaf after the surgery?
They can usually still hear something, but they're probably, if they're at that point where their ear canals are end stage, they're probably not hearing very well anyways.
All right.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Stephen in Milwaukee has a small terrier mix. She pulls very hard on the leash. Stephen says, I'm aware that I might be at least 50% to blame. I bought a body harness. No way. I bought a gentle leader. No way.
Yep.
Any ideas on how to stop the tug of war?
Oh, good question. Number one, training. Okay, so, you know, making sure that you are working with a trainer and not trying to, you know, set yourself up for failure. And this is why, you know, they're out there so they can teach you how to have a dog walk on a leash effectively. Many people will, when they have a dog that's pulling on a regular collar, initially go to a standard harness where it does up over the dog's back. And that's similar to the harness that they put on sled dogs. And guess what sled dogs do?
Pull.
Okay. So it dissipates all the pressure over their chest so they can pull even harder. You know, little dogs, head collars, they don't stay on real well. A lot of dogs don't like them. But there is an in-between thing, and the type of harness that I like to use, there's a brand out there called the Easy Walker Harness, and it's a harness that there's one band that goes around the chest wall, right kind of behind the front limbs, and then another band that runs forward, and it does up, the clasp is actually, the little ring that you hook up, the leash up to, is right at the front of the dog's chest, you know, just right between their front legs, kind of at the front. I'm pointing to my breastbone right now, so if all of you, you know, listeners out there can, you know, pay attention to that. Very effective for dogs that like to pull because it stops them from pulling forward. It's uncomfortable for them. And I found that for many chronic pullers, that's the best thing that's out there. So give that a try if you haven't tried that already.
Let's go to Matt next. Matt, hello to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I am calling about my dog, two dogs actually, that eat their own feces.
Oh, no. Okay. This is the second one. Yeah. With such a common problem, you know, and that's why I do a weekly or, you know, it's a couple times a month, a TV show, and it was the same and of course it's over dinner time. And this is always lunchtime. We have to get these calls in about dogs eating their own droppings. And it is a problem. It's a normal behavior problem for dogs, and it's a normal behavior for dogs. It's a behavior problem for us because we don't like it. I'll tell you the top three things that you're going to do to get this under control. Pick it up. I'm sorry if I'm, you know, just, you know, repeating myself there, but that's the most important thing you can do. And as owners, and I can admit I'm just as lazy as the next person. It's like, hey, it's cold out. I'm going to leave it and pick it up. And then it snows and then you don't get out there and get it. So you have to be out there with your dog. Put them out separately and it's going to be more work for you. If you have to, have them on a leash. As soon as they defecate, give them something else that they can do. Chase a ball, do something else while you pick this up. So instead of defecate, turn around and eat it, it's defecate, chase a ball. Look at their diet. I mean, if you've got them on a high quality diet, very unlikely that's going to cause any, you know, that's a dietary reason. If you've got them on a really poor quality, not a lot of non-digestible material out there, and everybody knows those diets, I'm not going to name them, then you may, you know, find that changing to a higher quality diet may prevent some of this too. But rarely is it ever a nutritional or a medical cause. Dogs that have digestive upsets and so on are going to have, you know, diarrhea and losing weight and have other things going on. There's some products on the market that you may want to try that make the stool taste bad. There's one called Forbid and the other one called Deter. Deter's motto is the number one product for dogs that eat number two. And they make the stool taste bad. Goes in one end and out the other. Now, I'm going to use a little human analogy is why these usually fail. Most of the time when I get people calling me with this problem, it's a longstanding problem. And so, you know, Larry, you like to eat apples, right?
Right.
And, you know, you've been eating apples all your life, and all of a sudden you bite into one that's yucky and mealy and brown in the middle, and you're like, ugh. Do you give up on apples totally?
No.
Or you just say, oh, bad season for apples. I'll try again later. So I'll let you figure it out when you're using these products. If the dog's been eating feces successfully, then, you know, all of a sudden, oh, bad season for poop. I'll try again later. So it works for puppies, works for dogs that are newly doing this, but it rarely works for dogs after, you know, they've been doing it for a while. Another product that you can try that you can use daily is one that's called Prozyme. It's probably not doing anything from the digestive standpoint. My guess is that it's making the stool taste bad as well. But you're using it once a day and every day. And so the dog just, you know, you're not giving up the product like you are when you're using those products you just use for a short period of time. So it's worth trying. Whether it's going to work or not, I don't know. But, you know, buy a toothbrush, keep your dog's mouth clean so that when they kiss you, you don't care, and be out there with your bags. So.
All right. Thanks for that call. And Andy emailed with this question. My elderly cat, 18 plus, gets in the litter box to urinate, but she hangs her rear end over the side and pees on the floor. I've bought a hooded litter box, but she refuses to use it. Any ideas?
Yeah, you know, 18-year-old cat probably has some arthritis issues. And what we find is, remember, when we're sizing litter boxes, we need to have the litter box at least 1.5 times the length of the cat's body from nose to butt. So it has to be big. Some cats don't like deep litter, and they find that if they get in there, they can't posture appropriately because it hurts. Imagine, you know, an elderly person walking over a rough surface if they've got some bad hips and bad knees. So put in a minimal amount of litter so that it's, you know, easier for your cat to walk in. Consider a low-sided box that's bigger so that your cat can get in comfortably and move around a little bit easier. Covered boxes, again, if you've got an arthritic cat, they can't turn around in it very well, and you may see that they're hanging their butt out over the edge anyways, even with that. So, you know, be looking at redesigning the toilet facilities for your cat to make it more age appropriate, and hopefully that will help.
And we have another email from Stephanie, who's Akita has a partially torn ACL. Her question is, will a raw food diet help with a faster and stronger recovery? He's been on Nature's Valley Patties for about a week. What's your opinion on
that? Yeah, probably not. The best things that you can do, if he's even got a partial rupture, boy, he's still probably going to end up with some arthritis in his joint. I'd be looking at using, rather than a raw diet like that, there are some therapeutic diets out there, one that's called JM and the other one that's called JD. One's made by Nestle Purina and one's made by Hill's. And they are a joint diet to help with joint repair, joint, you know, maintaining the, not really, well, repair. They give you the right building blocks and so on for keeping the joints healthy. But they also have the right levels of fatty acids to help alleviate some of the inflammatory changes that can be occurring in the joints as well. I'd be making sure that your dog is on appropriate doses of glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, and you may even want to talk to your veterinarian about going through a round of a product called Adequin Canine, which is a polysulfated glycosaminoglycan. They use it in horses a lot, but we also use it in dogs, and that helps too. Rest, rest, rest. That's another thing that you need to do. People will go back to activity way too fast with these. You're looking at weeks of limited activity and leash walks, but keeping up still with physical therapy, such as underwater treadmills and swimming and things like that, that will give your dog some buoyancy and yet keep that muscle structure going. So don't forget about the physical therapy.
Mike in Mozanique, how are you today?
Hey, pretty good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We're getting my mom a small lap dog. She hasn't had one for a couple of years. Problem now is that we got a neighbor that has like a lab that seems to be somewhat aggressive, and I'm not positive the neighbor keeps very good discipline on him. And the only thing separating my mom's dog chain and their dog chain would be a couple parked cars. So I'm wondering, what's a good way of introducing a small dog like that to the neighborhood new dog?
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, is some basic tips on potty training, again, to get the dog to go outside, since my mom has new carpeting, if you could.
Yeah. Well, the potty training is actually going to be pretty easy. The kind of the rules of potty training is that your eyes are never off the dog. If your eyes have to be off the dog, then they're confined to a small space where they're going to be less likely to want to eliminate, such as in a crate or something like that. But you can't crate abuse them. They can't be in there for hours, or they'll end up, you know, going and sitting in it. So when the dog is loose in the house, eyes are on the dog. You don't eat, sleep, watch TV, do anything. You're always watching the dog. So as soon as they stop playing, you're right there to pick the dog up or get the dog on a leash and take them outside. The other rules with housebreaking is owner goes outside with the dog, and that may help alleviate some of the problems with the Labrador Retriever next door. So don't just hook the dog up on a leash and have it be outside unattended. The reason why you need to be out there is the dog needs a positive reinforcement, a reward for going to the bathroom. So as soon as their fanny's coming up off the ground, that's when you're going to give them a wonderful little treat that they get at no other time, such as a, you know, little bit of freeze-dried liver or doggy beef jerky, just something to drive that point home. Kind of like when I was toilet training my daughter and you giving her M&Ms, you know. She's 16 right now and I don't hand M&Ms out, okay? It just drove that point home early on. So that's the kind of thing that you're going to be doing. So it's a little time consuming, but if you know, do it right, you can have a dog fairly reasonably housebroken. But remember, smaller dogs are harder to housebreak than bigger dogs.
45 seconds to go here.
Okay. So what do we do about the neighbor's dog? I talk to your neighbor. See if they can be introduced, you know, neutral turf, not having the dog out and wandering. And again, this would be a case of not having this dog unattended out in the backyard. It needs to have somebody there because it's just a sitting duck. It's going to be looked at as lunch. So,
no.
Yeah, have that dog socialized. Even though it's little, it needs to go to training class so it knows that dogs come in all different sizes and packages.
Sandy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And you will be back on March 10th.
10th, that's right.
We will really look forward to that. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. And sorry we didn't get to all of the calls and all the emails. There were lots that we couldn't get to, but that's kind of the way it works. I'm sorry for that. Just to let you know, coming up tomorrow, we'll talk with Vicki Piaskowski of Birds Without Borders. Interesting group, and we'll have a conversation with her about Birds Without Borders and answer some bird questions for sure. And then our outdoor fishing guide, Gary Engberg of Mazamani, offers his Signs of Spring. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.